I'm Roseanne Cash. I'm sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. One of Time's 100 most influential people and the most cited physicist, Lisa Randall is at the forefront of research exploring how the universe works. When she is not busy solving complex mathematical equations and theoretical questions, she is writing bestsellers that break down the universe in layman's terms, like Warped Passages, Knocking on Heaven's Door, both New York Times Notable Books of the Year by HarperCollins, and her latest, Higgs Discovery, is a timely ebook published by Random House about the new scientific discovery with the potential to radically shake up our world. I recently became friends with Lisa. I am just delighted to welcome her back on our show. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. It's so nice to have a conversation.
You're in Aspen, aren't you?
I am in Aspen. In fact, I was running a little late because I went for a little hike this morning.
Is that at the is it the Ideas Festival?
Actually, believe it or not, there's a Center for Physics here in Aspen.
Wow.
And people get together for the summer for workshops to talk physics and give talks and have conferences. It's quite interesting here.
Well, a fellow Harvard scientist, psychologist Steven Pinker, raved that your book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, explains the greatest scientific endeavor in history, one that is exploring the earliest, smallest, largest, most powerful phenomena in the universe, and that may answer the deepest questions about the nature of physical reality. How have we gained this novel insight into the workings of the world?
Well, we're actually in the process of gaining the insights. He's, of course, referring to the machine called the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
Large because it's really big. Hadron because it collides together protons. And collider because it really does bang them together at high energies. And what's going on is that we're exploiting E equals MC squared, that you have more energy. You can make heavier particles with bigger masses M. And in doing so, you can explore a structure that you wouldn't otherwise see. You can see shorter distances, higher energies, heavier masses. And by doing that, you find out what underlies the matter that we see in our daily lives. It doesn't change what we see in everyday life, but it's sort of like looking under the hood. What's there? What's behind it all?
And is that what CERN, the European Organization of Nuclear Research, is that what they set out to accomplish with the Hadron Collider?
Absolutely. I mean, there's one point of view, which is I do theory, I don't do experiments, so we predict. What do you expect to find there? One of the predictions, of course, that's in the news these days is the Higgs boson. But there are many other predictions. And in fact, the experiments there are looking to verify or, as importantly, rule out these predictions. But the thing is, there's an element of humbleness even among physicists, and we know that there could be a lot of things we haven't even anticipated. So the idea in these experiments is to really look quite broadly, to look for things that we can identify and also look beyond that and see what is actually out there.
You know, I was reading your book, the Higgs boson book, or the Higgs discovery book, and you said something so interesting. You said that some physicists didn't want to discover the Higgs boson because they thought there could be something even more interesting to be discovered. Discovering the boson ruled out other particles they might have discovered.
And it's true. It's funny because I have, my two lives as a physicist and speaking to the public. So, and I've realized just how hard it is to explain something.
It is,
like,
yes.
The fact that
it's hard to understand it, yes.
But I guess the best way of understanding it is that there's really a couple of things going on. One is what's known as the Higgs mechanism.
Right.
The Higgs mechanism is associated with particles getting their masses.
You make a masses. Distinction between the mechanism and the boson itself. You're very careful about that in the book, aren't you?
I am, and I think it's really important even to understand this, what sounds like a cockamamie idea, because we really do believe the Higgs mechanism happened. And then the question is, what's implementing it? What are the actual particles out there that makes this mysterious mechanism we can come back to happen? And so that's where these physicists are coming in and saying, look, we know this mechanism is occurring, but it could be something even more interesting that underlies it. Is it the simplest possibility, which involves this particle called the Higgs boson, or is it something more complicated? And if it's something more complicated, it gives us a hint a big hint as to what lies beyond what we call the standard model of particle physics. That's the stuff we already know about. And we're trying to go beyond it. So the more things deviate from our expectations at this point, the more we learn about what's underlying the standard model.
So if they did find the Higgs boson, it doesn't rule out some of these other mysterious particles you're talking about. Is that correct?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, one of the really exciting things that's happening this year is the machine is running a couple of months longer than was originally anticipated. And the reason they're doing that is to measure the interactions of this particle. I mean, it looks like it's a Higgs boson. It is a Higgs boson, but what are its precise properties? Because again, knowing those properties gives you a hint. How does it interact with particles we know about gives us a hint about what's there beyond what we know about. So in fact, I like to believe that the Higgs boson will be one step in a much broader search. I mean, what's going to happen is the Large Hadron Collider will turn off for about a year and a half and turn back on in about twice the energy. And when it does that, it has the capacity to even see what underlies the Higgs boson.
Wow.
And that could be something really exotic. It could involve, one of the things I've worked on is a warped extra dimension of space or something called supersymmetry. They're really exotic possibilities. And if we have enough energy, we expect to find something even richer and deeper.
You know, I know that your area of interest right now, I guess, is supersymmetry. And so you must be kind of waiting with bated breath for 2 years from now when there more light might be shed on that.
Well, you know, I'm really pretty open-minded. I'm not one of the people that says supersymmetry absolutely has to be there. What I like to do is say these experiments, you know, we have this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The Large Hadron Collider is running now.
Right.
So what we want to do is come up with the broadest possible range of models so that the Large Hadron Collider doesn't miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
So when I work on supersymmetry, I'm not saying I know it's right. What I'm saying is, what are the possibilities consistent with everything we've seen before? And are they really doing the experiments that would find all these different versions of the theories? And so I don't work exclusively on that. I've also worked on, like I said, this warped extra dimension. I really keep an open mind, and I just want to make sure we get the answers.
Can you give me an eighth grade definition of supersymmetry and warped dimension?
So, good. So supersymmetry, let's start with that.
Okay, good.
So supersymmetry says that for every particle we know about, there's a partner particle. So what would that mean? That would mean if supersymmetry really existed and it was completely exact, it was an exact symmetry, we know there's an electron in the world, there would be a partner particle called a selectron. It would have the same mass and the same charge, interactions related to those of the electron. Now, we haven't seen that particle, and we would have been able to at a collider. So we know that supersymmetry is not exact. The superpartners, as they're known, are a bit heavier. And their mass is such that they can be found, if it's correct explanation of what's going on at this scale, at the Large Hadron Collider. So what you would be looking for in a supersymmetric model are particles that have the same charges, related interactions to all the particles we know about, but would be somewhat heavier. And there's various versions of how this can come about. Some might be a little bit heavier than others. The interactions can be a little bit different. But that's the basic underlying idea. And the reason people believe that supersymmetry might be present is there's a big mystery about why the Higgs boson mass is what it is. Why isn't it ridiculously heavier? And that's because of what quantum mechanics tells us it should be. And in these supersymmetric theories, there are cancellations because of all these new particles that actually make the theory seem more consistent.
Can you keep
track?
Can you keep track of all of these cancellations and exceptions to the rules and virtual particles? And
well, yeah, it's a full-time career.
I would guess so.
It is a full-time job. It sounds complicated when phrased that way, and that's sort of the difference. But, you know, there's sort of these beautiful theories, and a lot of the time when we present our ideas to the public, you want to focus on the beautiful underlying core concepts. But as you know, the world around us is a little bit messy, and so you have to match those beautiful ideas onto what's actually going on. And that's effectively what model building is. That's the kind of theoretical work that I and a lot of my colleagues do, is to see what really are the clever ideas that underlie what actually is going on. So first of all, there's some deep underlying principles, maybe, like supersymmetry. But then there's these messier parts, which is how are these symmetries broken so that it matches onto our world? And in some sense, the same thing is true in these this warped extra-dimensional idea that you mentioned also.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
And that's, in some ways, even a more beautiful concept in the sense that the idea is that there really is an extra dimension of space. That is to say, a dimension of space that we don't experience beyond the three we know about, left, right, forward, backward, up, down. There really could be these other dimensions of space, but we don't see them and we don't experience them yet. Why is that? Well, one reason is that they could be super small. Another reason is that they could actually be what's called warped. The gravity of these in this extra dimension could be so different that it looks very different from the point of view of us living in our what seems to be a three-dimensional world. And the reason this theory is so interesting from the point of view of the Large Hadron Collider is it also has this potential to explain why the Higgs boson mass is what it is. And it really involves the idea that gravity varies in an extra dimension in such a way that masses where we live in this region of higher dimensional space is exactly what it is. And what's so great about both of these ideas is that they do have experimental consequences. If we reach high enough energies at these collisions, we will be able to find evidence of these theories if they are in fact correct in the real world.
You bring up, I want to ask you an almost metaphysical question, which is that could we develop over time as a race a sense or an intuition, an extra sense to perceive this warped dimension? Is that something you think about for humanity? And
so one of the ideas that I focus on in my recent book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, not the Higgs discovery, but Knocking on Heaven's Door, is the theme of scale. And the idea is that, and it's really important when we think about questions like this, because, for example, on human scale, we really know about our five senses, and that is how we interact with the world. And a lot of that is related to electromagnetic interactions, the way we see, right, or the way we touch. And so it could be these other dimensions. It could be we interact only via gravity. Gravity is an extraordinarily weak force. Of course, the entire Earth acting on you gives you a big effect. But gravity from individual small objects is negligible in terms of our interactions with those objects. And so even if these other dimensions exist, we would have to be different as human beings on the scales that we exist. It doesn't mean that we can't develop technology and we can't eventually have very sensitive probes that allow us to see what underlies the things that are obvious to us as human beings. But just in terms of our intuition, in terms of what we experience in our daily lives, unless we're attached to gadgets eventually that can probe these really tiny distances or these really weak interactions, no, we would not generally know about them.
I'm speaking with Lisa Randall, a professor of physics at Harvard University. She's the author of numerous books, including Knocking on Heaven's Door and Warped Passages. Her latest is a Kindle single called Higgs Discovery, The Power of Empty Space. Also, I'd like to let you know that on today's Fresh Air, Terry Gross speaks with Susie Arioli. The jazz singer has a new album called All the Way and will perform in studio. That's today at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. I'm Roseanne Cash, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll have more with Lisa Randall after the break. Hi, I'm Roseanne Cash. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Lisa Randall, a professor of physics at Harvard University. Lisa, you brought up something interesting to me as someone who loves theoretical physics, as a science geek and a layperson. I love it in the same way that some people love religion. You brought something up about beauty, and that's one thing that's so appealing to me about quantum mechanics is the language. The language can be so poetic. And you write that Keats' line, "Beauty is truth and truth is beauty," can be used as a gauge to tell whether a scientific theory is likely or far-fetched. Can you explain that?
So I'm actually probably a little bit more on the skeptical end of this, though.
I know you are.
I think that...
I like that. I like that.
I think that it is true that, you know, ultimately, we want simple principles. I'd say that something that we do look for is economy. We want to have simple ideas that can explain as much as possible and therefore allow us to be as predictive as possible. Really, one of the things I do love in physics is when you tie together different ideas. Mm-hmm. You see things that seem apparently disconnected, and you find some deep underlying principle by which they're connected and related. So that is, in a sense, very beautiful and very satisfying. But on the other hand, if you have something that's too, I mean, a lot of the time when people refer to beauty, they're thinking of very symmetric, orderly things. Now, that to me is wallpaper. I mean, that's not necessarily beautiful. And really, it comes back to this idea we were talking about earlier, that what you want are some really nice organizing principles, but you also generally have to find out, where is the disorganization coming from? How does that match onto our world? So I think looking for simple ideas, looking for exceptionally pristine ways of viewing a phenomena is very helpful, but it's not necessarily telling you the answer. And it's also not necessarily the end product, in the sense that you might have some simple underlying idea, such as the supersymmetry we talked about earlier, which you might not say is very simple, but it's a beautiful symmetry underlying what could be there. But it's not completely exact. It's broken, even if it exists in the world. We know that even without having found it, we know it cannot be exact. And actually, one of the really interesting things about the Higgs boson that was discovered is that it is associated with a breaking of a symmetry,
right?
A symmetry that existed in the early universe and is broken today. And so it's both that symmetry that's beautiful, but the breaking of the symmetry that's beautiful. And ultimately, it's only with experiments that we can tell which of these beautiful ideas are true in the sense that they are realized in nature.
Well, I love that. I mean, you're reminding me of the line that from a Leonard Cohen song. Leonard Cohen said, "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." To me, that
Excellent.
Was always one of the most beautiful definitions of beauty, is that it's not pristine. But, you know, I had a songwriter friend, John Stewart, who used to say to me, if he'd hear one of my songs and he thought they were too perfect, he'd say, "Where's the madness? Where's the madness? It's not going to be beautiful without the madness." So what you're saying, though, is science does not put an end to the contemplation of this mysterious divine beauty that, you know, that Keats talked about, but that it may be something different. It's not the kind of beauty that we're accustomed to.
That's right. And I mean, I think what drives, I mean, you know, I had this, I did a libretto for a small opera. And
I know
one
that.
One of the ideas of that was sort of what drives creativity is sort of dissatisfaction. It's sort of the pieces that are missing.
Yes.
If everything was there, you would be bored. You would just, or maybe just relaxed and happy. But it's not what drives discovery. It's not what drives great creations. It really is this fact that something's missing. There's some place you're trying to go, either in a composition or in a physical theory, to really get at something beyond where we are today.
Science is a creative endeavor, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people don't equate the two, but it's a very creative experience.
Yeah, in fact, I firmly believe that. In fact, I actually have a chapter about that, because I think it is true that a lot of the time people think that, you know, science is just you plug it in and it comes out. And there really are different kinds of science, and there are people who are more technicians and more who will just work out what they're supposed to work out. But a lot of it, when you really are looking for new ideas, is trying to put together ideas in a way that hasn't happened before. I mean, that is creativity. In fact, one thing that's really nice about science is this sort of constrained creativity. You can't just write down anything. You have to write down something consistent with what we see. But like I said earlier, it's something that you want to have deeper understanding, something that ties together phenomena.
But I imagine that you've had tremendous intuitive leaps that have led you in a direction that you didn't expect to go when you were writing theories. Is that right?
You know, I mean, when you look at it from the outside, there are times it looks like an intuitive leap. And sometimes maybe that's what it was. But of course, as you know, a lot of those intuitions come from staring really hard, in some cases a bunch of equations, in some cases a bunch of theories, and really seeing what the logical consequence is. So, you know, it involves having an open mind. It involves saying, you know, this isn't the way most people are going to look at this, which is in some sense intuition, but it's not just coming out of the blue.
Sure.
It's really coming from staring at these things for a long time and having a deep familiarity.
Right.
And seeing what are the true implications.
Your skill set is so refined that you're allowed to have intuitive flights. If you weren't as disciplined and had put as much work into it, then the intuition would just be kind of meaningless, I'm thinking. I mean, it's that way in songwriting anyway. It's, 30 years of putting...
No, it's true. It's just...
Go ahead.
I think it's more this sort of magical jump element. I mean, in some sense, it is a new way of thinking. And so in that sense, it is. But sometimes it really does, as you know, probably just seem like the logical next step, even though, from viewed from afar, it's like, wow, that was an intuitive leap. Sometimes it's like you've worked out all the possibilities. This is the only one left, what it has to mean.
I'm Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org, and I'm speaking with Lisa Randall. Lisa, let's talk for a minute about the Large Hadron Collider. There's something so kind of startling about the fact that it has the world's strongest vacuum, the world's strongest magnets. It's the world's coldest place. What is that about? It's chilled to 271 degrees centigrade, below minus, I mean.
So one way of saying it is that it's actually colder than empty space.
Colder than empty space. Thank you.
I mean, this is one thing that I do love. I do theory. I don't do experiments. I don't do technology. But there is something magnificent about the fact that what we're trying to do with these experiments is get to energies, get to distances that just haven't been explored before. And in order to do that, it's really stretching technology to its limits.
Right.
I mean, it's saying, what can we do with existing and how far can we push it? In order to make the Large Hadron Collider, these dipole magnets, as they're known, had to be developed. They had to first be developed and also be developed at a level that they can do it on a sort of industrial scale so that they can put the 1,000 magnets inside this tunnel. So it's not just developing the one little thing. It really is developing it so that you can have many, all of these magnets. And to have this extended vacuum, it's a really impressive achievement. I mean, one of the really impressive aspects of it is just the amount of data that gets produced and how the data gets processed. And in fact, I mean, I think it's fairly widely known by now, but the World Wide Web was developed at CERN, which houses the Large Hadron Collider. And that was a while ago because you wanted to get experimenters in different countries to be able to talk to each other as if they were in the same room. And so I think having these incentives to push things to their limits has all these side benefits of just that you have pushed technology as far as it can go at any given point.
How is so much data filtered? And then what do you do with it?
Well, one of the reasons that my job as a theorist is important is because there's so much data they can't record it all.
Right.
So one of the first important aspects is something called triggers, which is to say it's sort of like spam filters. It's stuff that will pull out what could potentially be interesting. Doesn't mean it necessarily is, but most of the stuff, and by uninteresting, I mean it's just standard model particles that we expected to be there. It's not telling us anything new.
You called it background.
Exactly, the background. And so we want to see a signal over the background, so we want to identify what are those important features. So the first step is just to not even record all of the data. But then it does get processed, and it's an elaborate process by which there's this tier computing, and it's sort of processed in different places at the same time, sort of the way information is processed via the World Wide Web. This is actually going on now. In terms of the actual computation. And eventually it's filtered down to a form that an individual or say a university can take the data and analyze it. And they can say, this is what they've recorded. I'm looking for this particular type of particle, this particular type of process or feature. And you can look for it in the set of data, which has been really winnowed down to a point where you can actually analyze it.
You said that that the Higgs boson is not just a new particle, but it was a new type of particle. What did you mean by that?
So this is a somewhat technical point, but it's actually a very interesting one. So there, as you might know, quantum mechanics divides particles into different categories. First of all, there's fermions and bosons. So what do we mean by that? Well, fermions are particles that don't want to be in the same place. Bosons are particles that do. But on top of that, they're distinguished by an internal property known as spin. Mm-hmm. Spin is like an angular momentum. That is to say, it sort of tells you how it's spinning. It's not actually spinning. It's just an intrinsic property of the particle. Now, this is very technical, but the fact is that particles like quarks and leptons, like the electron, they're all fermions. They have spin a half. Particles like the photon have what we call spin one. But the weird thing is that we have never seen a fundamental particle, that is to say a particle with no further subdivisions, that has spin zero. Spin zero is a boson, and the scalar boson. And we have never before found, there are particles that do have spin zero, but they're composites. They're made up of other particles. But this Higgs boson could conceivably be a fundamental particle that has spin zero. So in some sense, its exchange would be a different kind of force. It really is a new type of particle that has not been seen before. And that's why measuring its properties is so important.
You just called it a scalar boson, and that's the same thing as the Higgs boson, is that right?
Yeah, the scalar refers to the spin zero part of it.
I see.
So,
and why are people calling it the God particle?
Because Leon Letterman called it that in a book. And because then reporters like it because it sort of sounds
exciting. It's catchy. But does it have something to do with the unified field, with unifying all of these?
Well,
theories.
It does. You know, I was joking when I actually had an interview when it was first discovered, and I was actually in Greece at the time. I was like, well, you know, in a monotheistic universe, it's hard to call the Higgs boson the God particle. I mean, there are many particles that are very essential to putting it all together. So, yes, it is a very important particle. But there are many others important to putting it all together.
We wouldn't want to do without electrons, would we?
Yeah, so you know, maybe if we had a pantheistic universe, we could call them all God particles. But really, I think that it's a little bit of an overstatement.
Right. How many collisions were staged at the Large Hadron Collider before this boson, the scalar boson or Higgs boson emerged?
I can't tell you the number, but you know, there's like a billion a second. So
wow.
There's a lot of data being recorded. And really, you're pulling out very small fraction of the events when to find this Higgs boson.
Well, this is a rather prosaic question, but could the Large Hadron Collider ever provide electricity? And why did some people worry that it would create a black hole that would destroy the Earth?
I love that you call this a prosaic question. It's really funny. Well, the sad fact of the matter is that these colliders actually consume a lot of electricity because you have these superconducting magnets and you have to provide all the current for everything. You know, they actually, it's quite interesting. CERN has a deal with Geneva so that they run it only as they turn off at certain times in the winter so that they can be guaranteed that they will have the power they need. But actually providing a new energy source is unfortunately rather unlikely. In terms of black holes, that is a whole other story. And in fact, I have a chapter in my book about it because I do think it is interesting how it happened and what was going on. So the idea there, and it's a bit of a story, so I'm just going to take a step back and tell you. First of all, you generally don't make black holes in laboratories. To make ordinary black holes, you would require energies that are 16 orders of magnitude, one with 16 zeros after it, higher than what we actually achieve. Mm. Why didn't anyone think that you can make a black hole in laboratory? Well, it has to do with the extra-dimensional type theories that I mentioned earlier. If it's true, if those theories are right and they are relevant to the Higgs boson mass, it turns out that gravity in the higher dimensions, not in the dimensions we see, but higher dimensional gravity could get strong at the energies of the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, Lisa, this is more than my little brain can stand, but I hope I see you in a warp dimension or something more kind of standard. I've been speaking with Lisa Randall. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor of Physics at Harvard University, the author of numerous books, including Knocking on Heaven's Door and Warp Passages. Her latest is Higgs Discovery, The Power of Empty Space. Lisa, it's been so great. Thank you.